This is Berkeley Voices. I'm Anne Bryce.
I learned the viola starting in I think fourth grade. So starting since then, and then I was very active. I played in the Philadelphia Youth Orchestra and in other, you know, as many orchestras as I possibly could. Every day of my week, I had a rehearsal in high school.
Sagar Asnani is a PhD candidate in musicology and in medieval studies at UC Berkeley. He has been playing in UC Berkeley Symphony Orchestra since he first joined the campus in fall 2020. Since he was a kid, music and language have been central to Sagar's life.
I started speaking Hindi back in my, when I was a child, right? I grew up in a Hindi speaking household. So my day-to-day interactions would be this fun mixture of Hindi, English, and sometimes, because in India, every family also has like their own dialect or regional variety of a language that they speak. And so Sindhi was what my parents spoke.
His parents and two older brothers came to the U.S. from India in 1992, and Sagar was born in Allentown, Pennsylvania, 4 years later.
I wouldn't even register, right? If one of my family members like said half a sentence in one language and then completely switched for the other half. Oftentimes, we even do this thing of like, you know, you take a Hindi verb and then you add in like o-fying to it, or like some kind of English morphological suffix to it in order to make it work in an English sentence. So, you know, that we do that very, very often. You know, one humorous example is bakwas means like kind of BS, or like you're talking garbage. So we say we're bakofying. We're, you know, you're talking BS. And that's I don't think anyone except our family does that particular word, right? Each family has their own variety of words.
During college at the University of Pennsylvania, Sagar spent a semester abroad in Lyon, France, where he took classes on the history of medieval literature and on medieval music.
I started to see connections between the fact that all the music that I was studying in this Renaissance era and the Middle Ages had a very close connection to the texts I was studying in my literature courses. And so I started to see, you know, even in undergrad, these kind of, you know, tendrils poking at each other.
And now, in his research at Berkeley, Sagar is looking at songs written in medieval Europe, particularly between the 12th and 14th centuries in France. And in these music manuscripts, he looks for evidence of linguistic variation and dialectical differences from the kind of standard Parisian that we consider to be modern French today. He says only recently have scholars begun to use a wider variety of media and artistic expressions as a way to study language.
So the traditional thing has always been like literature, right? They'd use Chrétien de Troyes, they'd use these novels, and they'd use also poetry, which is not set to music. They'd use like the Lay de Marie de France, which are these kind of narrative poems, basically. And so all of that was kind of like the traditional source type for linguists. But in the past like 4 or 5 years, actually even longer than that, linguists have kind of moved out from just those kind of traditional literary text types and have thought about, oh, what happens if we talk about the press? What happens if we talk about legal documents? What happens if we talk about theater? If we unpack like the genre of music, we will find a record of how, and actually a very precise record of how language was spoken.
Wow. Is it a kind of a growing trend? Are more scholars starting to look at music in their work when studying language?
At least for the field I'm in, like medieval French historical social linguistics, no, not at all. You know, this is kind of uncharted territory.
Sagar says this kind of hegemony of Parisian French in music has become a little oppressive, even in the modern day.
We have a lot of stories about l'Académie Française and how, you know, there's very much one correct way to speak. It's called le bon usage, and that's a concept that dates back to the 17th century with Claude Fabre de Vaugelas.
Vaugelas was a French grammarian and original member of the Académie Française, who wrote a kind of meta-linguistic text on how to speak French well. And in modern-day linguistic interactions, says Sagar, we adhere to this idea that there's a correct way to speak and write.
You know, if we rely on kind of a authoritative one version, which tends to be Parisian, of a text, then we just lose a lot of the entire kind of transmission history and circulation of these pieces of music.
And in losing the history of pieces of music, he says, we've lost languages and cultures that were present and important to the time period. One example is Occitan, a language from medieval Europe. Many of the songs that Sagar has been using in his research are written in Occitan.
If I describe it in like very, very reductive terms, it's as if French and Italian had a baby. French, Italian, Spanish. It's kind of a weird mixture of all three. It was spoken very widely in what is now southwestern France. Auvergne, Toulouse, Poitiers, these cities. So even stretching into like the center part of the country, it was also the kind of main language, and it was the culture. Like, you know, we call the French, you would have called people who spoke Occitan the Occitans or the Occitan people. And so this was a very like high prestige culture actually in the 11th through 13th centuries in what is now southern France. And in fact, the first vernacular poetry, musical poetry by the troubadours, was in Occitan.
During the Albigensian Crusade of 1209, the French monarchy took over what was then called Occitania.
So after that, there was this kind of linguistic and textual appropriation of Occitan language texts by French authors for basically kind of constructing, you know, back then they weren't really thinking of constructing a corpus of things to call French, you know. They weren't thinking in terms of like, oh, this is the history of the French language and poetry, but that, you know, that the appropriation, the mixture of French and Occitan language in manuscripts containing Occitan song basically led down the road to this kind of historical appropriation of Occitan culture for as French. Scholars already have traced that citation to this manuscript, which contains troubadour Occitan song but with French influence. Liza Zingesser has written a really good book, Stolen Song, How the Troubadours Became French, on this. She's a professor at Columbia.
To read the different languages in music manuscripts from medieval Europe, Sagar has added a few more languages to his repertoire. To read Occitan, rarely taught in universities, he took Catalan, a close linguistic relative to Occitan. He also took Latin, German, and Italian, and is proficient to varying degrees in each. Last year, Sagar gave a talk on a paper he wrote at the inaugural meeting of the Bay Area Early Music Consortium.
The title of my paper was The Curious Case of Midwent, a sociolinguistic analysis of a hybrid Occitan-French motet.
A motet is a style of vocal composition that has gone through numerous transformations over many centuries. So in this motet that Sagar looked at, there were four different versions.
So what we realize is that the one version, Montpellier, which is like the most authoritative Parisian source, is also already revised in the Middle Ages. It's a version which is not the original.
And the three others contained non-Parisian regional dialects, including words in Picard and Occitan.
And so that's a transmission of the history of this one piece, that if we pay attention to those variants that get actually, in a scholarly edition, totally wiped out. Only thing that's left is the Montpellier version, in fact. Of most editions present the Montpellier, and they actually reject readings of many of those words based on the Montpellier version. And so what we get at the end is the fact, is this idea that, you know, this is our authoritative version for the piece. This is the correct way to sing it and to perform it. But that implicitly underlines, it reinforces the idea that this motet was Parisian, which none of the other evidence actually seems to bear the case for.
What do you take away from that when you're kind of looking at the big picture, when you discover these things? What does that kind of, I don't know. Yeah, what's your takeaway? What does it tell you about all the songs and the language that we know as kind of the right way or how it should be? And how do you kind of apply it to your understanding of other music and mm-hmm. language?
Yeah, I mean, part of what it kind of lays bare is the effect of both pedagogy and tradition on the rarefaction of what becomes a standard and the then hegemonic status of that standard. Vocal pedagogy in particular is known for having teachers berate their students for pronouncing things certain ways. You know, ever since there's a book by a scholar named Catherine Bergeron, Voice Lessons in Belle Époque, France. And that, you know, there she talks about how, you know, particular styles of singing were denigrated as being not correct or, not the way to sing, right? And that led to a particular style of singing that became dominant over the course of the 20th century. Mm-hmm. And the way that we hear music today is certainly not indicative of how a music would have been. You know, we can't just pick up a recording on YouTube and assume that's how it might have sounded. You know, every performer brings their own biases, ideas, and traditions to the fore when they perform something. But also, when we're talking about tradition and standard, not just in the realm of music performance, but also then in the realm of, you know, speaking different varieties of languages, right? Mm-hmm. And so this idea of the proper language has both ramifications on the stuff that we study from the past, but also on our day-to-day interactions today. Language-based algorithms are increasingly crucial to the way that we live today, right? Both on kind of our subscription models, on the rise of artificial intelligence. But if we're going to base all of these ideas on a standardized way of speaking, it kind of effaces a whole history of linguistic variation. I just wonder what is to come in the future of how, you know, how the computer will basically rarefy and make us all sound the same, make us all speak the same way, when that's just certainly not how humans work and interact and communicate in the first place.
What do you hope are the takeaways that other people learn from your research?
One is a really close investment with primary sources and, you know, not to take someone's word for, you know, a historical account or a narrative, and to actually go back and do the research by actually looking at whatever aspect of the original source that we can. You know, we're blessed to have so many manuscripts put up online in digital images today, which allows me sitting here in California to make such a detailed account of manuscripts that are sitting in Europe, you know, without actually ever having gone there. That's not to say I don't want to go there to actually see them, because that's also crucial. But, you know, the stakes of what we can do today in a digital age where all this is accessible makes it all the more imperative that we do that work, you know, in order to understand where our biases are coming from, where our ideas of what is standard, what is not, where they actually question those narratives, and to actually think about, you know, both, you know, to think about language as not something which we have to constantly correct each other and be like, oh, you spoke this wrong, you know, you said this past tense in the wrong way, but rather to accept different varieties of languages, especially in a world where, you know, today we have both national and linguistic boundaries kind of crumbling before our very eyes, right? Not in a bad way, but in an idea that we have so much more communication across them. And so when someone comes to you speaking with an accent you don't recognize, or with a prosody and a rhythm to their language that seems kind of off to you, don't be so quick to judge them, but rather, you know, accept that they're trying to learn and speak the language of you and trying to communicate with you on your terms, but also that, you know, that's actually a way of speaking a language and that we should cherish that because it's beautiful in its own way. And, you know, in the same vein, when you go abroad or when you go somewhere, you also take an effort to learn, you know, at least the basics, learn how to communicate with those around you, because you'll just get so much more out of the experience. Not, you know, not trying to rely on translation apps, though those are everywhere, but actually engaging with the different language, the different sounds around you. Because that's, you know, I found in all of my travels, I always try to learn some of the language before I go. And that's what's also led to some of my language learning, is that every time I know what people are saying around me, or can at least try, I'm welcomed more. I feel like I am in a place where I want to be rather than in a place where I'm just kind of an outsider. And so, yeah, you know, those are some of the large level takeaways that maybe I might come across in my very niche project.
I'm Anne Bryce, and this is Berkeley Voices, a Berkeley News podcast from the Office of Communications and Public Affairs at UC Berkeley. You can find all of our podcast episodes with transcripts and photos on Berkeley News at news.berkeley.edu/podcasts.
That's awesome.